Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hi, this is Henry Gilroy, co-executive producer of Star Wars Rebels. You're listening to Aggressive Negotiations.
Welcome to Aggressive Negotiations, the deep dive podcast about the Star Wars galaxy, where we go all the way from the depths of Mon Cal to the heights of Coruscant. I am one of your hosts, John Mills, and with me, as I'm always thrilled to have him here with me, is the very, very astute, learned, and wonderfully close friend of mine, Jedi Master Matthew Rushing. Matt, how you doing?
Well, I'm after an introduction like that, I'm doing fantastic, John. And I'm really excited to be here tonight, as I always am when we're doing aggressive negotiations. But we have a surprise coming up for everyone, which I'm not going to ruin just yet. But you know, I got to say something, John. We don't normally talk about trailers, but I just want to say that Solo trailer was sick. I just loved it, man. And I'm so excited to be a Star Wars fan. Mainly what we're going to talk about tonight, but you know, Solo's got me pretty jazzed. So
I too am very jazzed after that trailer, and I can also tell you that I'm jazzed because it looks great. I'm jazzed because the trailer was a lot of fun and I'm looking forward to it. And I'm also jazzed because the Star Wars family maybe can start healing now after the last 6 months of wonderful conversations that we've all had at each other's throats.
Let the healing begin.
Let's hug it out, y'all.
Come on, everybody. Just get a big old force bath. You know.
For sure. One last thing before we get to our special surprise is to let everybody know, you can go over actually to GoFundMe, the Nerd Party. We're in a little bit of an interesting situation right now, where we can use a little bit of help from you, our listeners. Any amount that you might be able to spare, because we've been hit with a claim that has put us in a position as a network where we do need to ask for help. So just a quick call for help. Just go to GoFundMe.com/TheNerdParty, and you can find all of the information there that you need about that.
Well, and make sure you're checking out things on Twitter with us at Join Nerd Party, and of course at the Jedi Masters. Be following us there. You can check out so many things that are happening here on the network. Find out more. You know, we've got the links there for the GoFundMe as well. So make sure you're just checking out and following us there. Facebook as well. Facebook.com/TheNerdParty is a great place to go for more information on what John was mentioning, as well as all the shows on the network. And then of course, when you're over at the website at thenerdparty.com, you can also go to thenerdparty.com/contact. If you want to send us an email, choose a show there, choose Aggressive Negotiations, and that email comes to John and I. And then last and not least, you know, if you love Aggressive Negotiations, help us out. Give us a star rating and review over there on Apple Podcasts. Let people know what you think of the show and help more people find us. All of those places are great places to be able to keep in contact with us as the show and, of course, the network at large.
Absolutely. With all of that palaver, I think it's time, Matt, to jump right into it and welcome our very special guest to talk about the Zygerian slaver arc on the Clone Wars and in the Clone Wars comic, Henry Gilroy.
Punch it.
So we are naturally overjoyed, really honored, and happy to welcome back to the show Henry Gilroy. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me on. Always excited to come on Aggressive Negotiations, and this invitation, couldn't say no to. It's been a really busy week for me, but thanks for making time.
Well, we're always happy to hear that you're having a busy week, and we won't press you for any details outside of that. But, you know, it's a natural, I mean, you know, a natural fit, I think, to have you discuss this specific arc, because you're the architect of both its incarnations, which is sort of a fascinating position to be in, I think, in terms of, you know, Star Wars lore and stories that we've enjoyed.
Yeah, I that's something I always felt, actually, even in the Attack of the Clones film and Revenge of the Sith. I really hoped that George would kind of at least call back to, you know, young Anakin's desire to want to go back and free the slaves, or really kind of touch on it. I think such a personal story for him. I had that story actually in mind in season one of Clone Wars, and I don't know if you know the story about it, but I always anticipated or saw it as you know, being executed in animation, and probably over multiple arcs. It was hard for me to see how we'd get it into one part. It's such a big story, and sure enough, you know, the producer at the time saw my premise for these three episodes. I think it had four episodes initially, and she was like, "Wow, this is probably going to destroy the studio if we try to, if we attempt to produce this." I didn't know it at the time. She just said, "Yeah, we can't do it." I wasn't sure if George ever saw it at the time, but I never saw his notes on it. And then, you know, after I had finished my writing on season two, I had was invited by Dark Horse to, write some stories that maybe weren't approved. And that was like, oh, right off the bat, kind of one of my favorites. So, 9 months down the road, you know, I think George saw it during season three and he's like, you know, how come we never did this story? This is a great story. And, ironically, it came back to animation. So, I remember Dave called me and said, yeah, so George saw your comic book and he wants to do it. And I thought the irony of that was really funny, that I wrote something for animation. It never got to see, the light of day, but, you know, became a comic book and then went back to animation before. I don't think that's ever happened to any story I've ever written before. And I've been writing animation a long time. So,
well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I feel as though, and I think I remember Dave saying this on the, you guys did a video commentary on the Clone Wars Blu-ray set. And I think I remember him saying that this is really the first major EU thing to become canon, where they took part and parcel everything that somebody had done and put it into, you know, George level canon, which that's another huge feather in your cap.
Season four, I mean, we put little callbacks whenever we could, and I know Dave definitely has done that throughout the Clone Wars. I never really thought about it that way, because I originally wrote this story to be in the Clone Wars animated series. I wrote it for the animated series. So the fact that I started to do these comics for Dark Horse, I wasn't going to change the kind of stories I wrote. I was going to continue on. And actually, it's kind of awesome that George saw it and went, oh yeah, this story belongs in the Clone Wars. Like, he recognized that story was written for the animation. But he loved the stuff in the comics. There's a lot of EU stuff he really liked. So, and you saw it make its way into the Clone Wars, with Voss and, Ventress and just to name a few, you know.
So, you know, set the scene though, because you're adapting your own work. I mean, in a sense, you're kind of making a movie of a book you wrote. sort of thing. Did it come with any directives? You know, when they said go ahead and make this, what directive were you given? Was it simply, and it's got to be an X number of episodes, or was it something where you had to go back and reflesh out and make certain changes to make that leap into the film format?
Yeah, if you've seen the comic book, you know that some things were changed. And some of that comes down to storytelling preference, for example. But just to kind of preface that, George basically, Dave called me one day and said, hey, George saw your comic and he wants to do it. He wants to adapt it. And I was like, awesome. And I think that most of the direction he's like, doesn't want really to change. He just wants you to do the comic. So pretty much kind of just transcribe it over. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I thought, you know, in some places, certain kind of dialogue works better on the page than it does in a scene. You know what I mean? So it's obviously we made some changes like that. There was one sort of plot element thread that I had where because the Togruta people were the people who were kidnapped, that there was sort of an emotional aspect to it for Ahsoka, which was a question about like, oh, maybe these are her people. Maybe this is where she came from originally. Some hint of that. But I think actually it's probably better, as George said, no, he wanted to kind of remove that and put the focus more on Anakin. And also, yeah, when you think about it, Ahsoka, you know, when she became a Jedi, really, it's like the Jedi become her people. And then as a Jedi, everyone's her people, right? So she doesn't really, I mean, she might have an advantage if you know, there were like Togruta who wanted to only deal with another Togruta or something like that. I think that happens all the time, you know, the Jedi acting as diplomats, but kind of the fact that they're like diverse as far as their alien species and that kind of thing really helps them, rather than, oh, wait, she's got an attachment to this particular group for no other reason than they're just the same species as her. So anyway, that's one thing that was changed.
For you in making the adaptation, because I had just rewatched the arc last week and then I reread the comic series, was there anything for you that you wish had been able to make it? And just because of the time, you only have, you know, I think 22 minutes for a Clone Wars episode, where, you know, for time, you just end up having to cut a section out. But, you know, you're like, man, I wish that part had still been able to make it.
I'm trying to think. I don't know. I mean, I thought Brian and the directors did such a great job. Killian designed the locations. Actually, you know, I wasn't at Lucasfilm working at the studio. I kind of did this remotely, freelance. I think at that point, most of the writers were freelance. So I was remote, but Killian basically, you know, was kind of telling me how the design was going, kind of updating me about, you know, how difficult it was to kidnap a planet full of people, because that's something in television animation you really can't do. Right. So, I'm trying to think of the things that I don't know. I thought it was great. I was really pleased with the whole thing. I'm trying to think of just I think that if you try to cram, like, that's a lot of story into, you know, a three-parter like that. I don't know. I thought it was a great job. You know, I think I had Ventress, show up.
Yes, you did. Yeah.
And it's funny because I watched the episodes recently, but I didn't get a chance to look at the comics, but I thought there were definite improvements. But I think at the end of the day, the one thing, and I think Dave gave me a chance to complain about this on the DVD, was I thought that in some semblance of Anakin kind of getting a chance to end slavery, is he was the guy who was basically going to blow up that prison at the end. And in the comic, I had a scene where Palpatine basically is like, kind of calls over the political call and says, hey, don't blow that up, because we might need that in the future, you know, who knows for what reason. And on the other hand, because Anakin has seen what terrible things have gone on there, him and Obi-Wan are like, yeah, that we're gonna blow this place up. You know what I mean? So you can bleep me, but sorry about that. But I think because it basically showed a strong reaction from Obi-Wan, who realized like, oh, now that I've kind of been put in Anakin's spot, I can understand like how strongly he feels about it. And I think I actually had a scene. There was another scene, I think a longer conversation about where Anakin talks a little bit about his, to his mother, about his mother. And I think that's with Ahsoka. I'm not sure what happened to that, scene, because I think it really educated like, oh wait, we're not supposed to have attachments, but really it's the sort of thing where she could look at that and go like, oh, that's really interesting. You know, cause he definitely has an issue with attachments, and ultimately it's kind of a little bit of foreshadow, as we always tried to do in Clone Wars, to foreshadow how Anakin, you know, would turn to the dark side. In this particular case, Dave argued that if Palpatine called Anakin and gave him an order, because he's the Supreme Chancellor, Anakin wouldn't defy him. I think that basically it was one of those things where also we just ran out of time too in the episode. It was like, oh, it's time for the good guys to blow this place up. So anyway, that scene at the end I felt was something that was a more of a connection between Anakin and Obi-Wan. And now Obi-Wan understanding Anakin a little more, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I actually like that scene in the comic, you know, as well. And I think I would personally fall on the side of there would be things that Anakin would have, you know, like, I mean, it's something that reverberates through the whole storyline, whether it's, you know, in the comic or on screen, that this is an issue Anakin cannot just roll over on anything about. This is so deeply personal. But something else I found was interesting that's, you know, both in the comic and on screen, is that it addresses that Anakin has enough nobility in him that the queen, I guess queens have a thing for something about Anakin, you know, is how I would classify it.
That's great. Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's something about also the queen, and the best kind of Star Wars stories to me have this element of power. They're all about power and what you do to get power and what you do to stay in power, and how getting power changes you. I think that's something that I see in our daily life. When you just kind of look at the political situation right now and you look at how power changes people and what they'll do to hang on to it and keep it. And I think in her case, she's going like, oh, wait, besides just the vanity aspect of Anakin, she's really thinking like, wow, I can control the Jedi, which is like, no, there's no way that's ever going to happen. And even Dooku's like, wow, you've been out of the game a little too long, lady. And so I think that's a really interesting, anytime you can do stories about Anakin that kind of revolve around power and the foregoing of it and the surrender of it, I think is really interesting.
Well, and that's something that I thought that what I really love about the story that you created in the comic, and of course what we got on screen, is the conversations that Anakin has with the queen and the ideas of power and slavery and how it alludes to and shows us. And somebody actually calls out for the first time that the Jedi are actually in the wrong, that they are slaves to the Republic and they don't know it yet, but it will be their undoing. And I love that you just had the guts to go there in this show, because I felt like this arc does such a great job of setting up why the Jedi fall, and they're too blind to see it.
I thought
it was brilliant.
Oh, thanks man. Yeah, it's you know, obviously for sharing credit with the Clone Wars teams and the actors, everyone like killed it. The idea of the Jedi who basically, when a bad guy says, you're the one who's bad, I'm not bad, you're like, yeah, you're crazy, and then you take them to jail. And I think in this particular case, the fact that she's like, yeah, the Jedi have just become slaves. The Republic is not any better than we are. So why don't we just basically take back power and, you know, create the slave empire again? So I think that's really great that, Anakin and Obi-Wan definitely don't see it that way. However, it's later revealed that, oh, yeah, they really have betrayed who they are. And I think that's one reason why the queen, in my mind, thinks that actually she can get Anakin under her thumb. Because she believes, okay, if this guy will go against his core belief system of fighting a war, of becoming a soldier and actually becoming a general and fighting all these battles, there's probably a good chance that I can get him to fight for me. Anyway, that's the way I saw the logic in her mind anyway, of like, because I think everybody would think like, yeah, how are you going to get a Jedi to turn? There's no way a Jedi would turn unless they already have and just haven't realized it yet.
So what do you think it is that makes it so much harder for her to manipulate somebody like Dooku? Because, you know, obviously there are parallels between the path Anakin is on and where Dooku wound up. What is it about Dooku or the Sith that, is it just because they're in the position already of the powerful and so it's that much harder to subvert them for someone like her?
Yeah, I think that she thought, ultimately, she probably thought she could get enough Jedi on her side. She wouldn't need Dooku, and she wouldn't need the Sith. So the idea that and there's probably certain aspects of the Separatists who would totally be against the Zygerian slaver empire. I think the Zygerians really are the machinations of the Sith. And yeah, really, again, it's the lure, the promise of power that Dooku and the Emperor are given the Queen. I think that when she starts to kind of go outside of their guidelines and starts to kind of change the rules, that's something that's that's ultimately her undoing.
And that's the thing that I really was resonating with it this watch through and read through the comic, was just the way that, especially in the episodes, we are, Palpatine is already like acting almost as if he's won, because he's setting up the chess pieces for when he's going to be building all of these things, whether it's Death Stars or, you know, monuments to himself or whatever. Dave even makes a joke about how the monument in Return of the Jedi was made by these people from Kairos, which I thought was great. He's already talking about how we're bringing back the Sith Empire. And Sith empires are built on the back of slaves. So we got to start, you know, making sure we've got enough slaves to keep this empire going for, you know, the next 1,000 years, hopefully.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Emperor's playing the long game. Obviously, if he's put the Order 66 thing in the clones, like he knows what he's doing. So the fact that he got Yoda and the rest of the Jedi Council to say, yeah, we're going to fight this clone war. That was like half the job right there. Because then he knew once basically you started war, yeah, nobody's going to come out of that unscathed. And then he could whittle the Jedi down to the point where Order 66 would actually work. And again, it goes back to the power aspect of it. And I think, generally speaking, people who seek power and who they do hold sway in the way they can influence people. They can do it for good or evil, but really a lot of times they lose sight of the fact that they're starting to basically become self-serving. And a lot of people think the Jedi are evil. And I think that's a really great kind of cool thing that the Clone Wars explores is, yeah, the Jedi have been basically called out for their nonsense a lot. That's why when you watch the Clone Wars and then you watch Revenge of the Sith, and when Anakin goes, you know, no, the Jedi are evil. It's all a point of view. And when I first saw Revenge of the Sith, I didn't understand how Anakin could have made that turn. Like, man, how could he have made that turn to like calling the Jedi Council evil and all that, because he's been through all of this stuff and like totally been distorted and harmed by war. And so he's definitely more open to seeing that, okay, there's a bureaucracy right here that's basically betrayed itself.
Well, and there's a real difference between when Obi-Wan is and I love the scene where Obi-Wan is just fighting the guy and biding his time so Anakin can take out the, you know, the bombs with Ahsoka. It's just fantastic. But I love that during that scene, we get some exposition that it's the Jedi who are responsible for the Zygerian slaver empire ending in the first place over 1,000 years ago. So we get this opportunity to see that the Jedi used to be this force for good in the galaxy when they were doing what they should be doing. And that they are responsible for ending this horrible empire in the first place. And that's why, you know, Zygerians hate Jedi. But I thought that that was really neat because it's a juxtaposition to where the Jedi are now.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. Oh, yeah, that's great. You know, I didn't even think about that. The fact that, yeah, that the Jedi basically get wiped out because just like the Zygerians did. And that wasn't conscious. Just about all of the scenes, I tend to try to kind of use the Joseph Campbell thing. I try to like have the theme demonstrated in action. So if you think about that scene, really, while Anakin and Ahsoka are out there trying to find the bombs, basically, Obi-Wan is more or less a slave to them. If you think about it, he's got to sacrifice himself and let himself get the crap kicked out of him. Even though he could take this guy out anytime he wants, which I thought the director did at the end of the episode, sound fantastic at the end of Kidnapped. But, and then you have a scene later on where Ahsoka's put in a cage, and I have no doubt that she could get out of that cage if she wanted to. But the fact she's sitting in there meditating is she's really in service to Anakin, basically dealing with the queen. She's biding her time, not even so much for herself, but for her friends. And I think that's the great thing about the Jedi is they really will like put aside themselves for the service of something larger. And even the queen even says that to a certain extent. And that's really what makes them so powerful. And ultimately I think any group of people who's willing to go, okay, wait, I'm going to surrender my own power for the good of the team or for the good of everyone.
Yeah, something that I enjoyed seeing you call out actually in the comics that that doesn't really get played with in the on screen adaptation is also this idea of the propaganda that the separatists are most nervous about the idea that their lie about the Togrutans being wiped out is going to be exposed if they get freed. What I wanted to ask was, do you think that resonated enough on screen? Was there enough? Did I just miss it when I was watching it, or is it just something that just sort of gets, you know, it was one of those wavelengths that has to get muted?
No, I think definitely that was the difference. That I think ultimately you're right. I remember playing that up, and it was like the separatists know that. Well, like George said, there's heroes on both sides. So the separatists aren't all bad. They really come from the point of view of, yeah, there are parts of the Republic that are corrupt. So there are parts of the separatists who are justified, you know, which I think we've been like are established all kind of out throughout the Clone Wars series. In my mind, the slavery issue, the removing that element is fine because it's really about the Sith. This is a Sith plan. It's not a separatist plan. You know what I mean? So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that cutting that out in my mind was, okay, it's more about, you're right, Count Dooku losing face. This is something that would basically be like, if the separatists were to win the war, this is something that would be slowly kind of pulled back. But remember, Sidious has no intention of letting the separatists win the war. He just wants to take over the Republic, right? So he knows mm-hmm. he can turn off the droids anytime he wants. So, it's just the war has its purpose to just create chaos and all this upheaval and basically kill Jedi. So But I see your point. I guess in my mind, this simplifies it to just make it about the Sith. And, you know, if you think about it, if you were to go to some foreign country and you saw like human trafficking going on, there's a chance you might be the only person in the room who goes, ugh, this is disgusting, where other people in the room are bidding. And so it speaks to, you know, how there are bad people out there who will take advantage of other people. So and that's why we need the Jedi. That's why we need the Jedi right now.
Yes, I would agree. It would be really great to have some Jedi in the world right about now. I think we need them for sure.
Yeah, that's something that watching through the episodes and reading the comic, I also really liked the way that this is the first time that Ahsoka gets her experience with Anakin's background. Because in the very first, you know, in the movie, Anakin says, you forget it was Master Skywalker who said, I don't want to talk about it.
Right.
And so this is the first time that she hears, and Obi-Wan, I really love that tender scene between her and Obi-Wan where he says, you know, Anakin was a slave, and, you know, kind of giving her the 411 on why, you know, this is really bothering him so much. And it gives her a whole new perspective on her master. But then by the end of the episode, you know, this has left Obi-Wan worried about Anakin. And he tells Ahsoka to keep an eye on him, and she says that she will. And I just thought that was so interesting because, again, you did a great job in kind of foreshadowing that it's kind of one more notch of Anakin seeing where the Republic is failing to lead him to say, you know what, just screw it. You know, this is dumb. Let's take it over.
Yeah, I think that there were a couple of other instances where we kind of went down the road. Once they got to Zygeria, where Ahsoka kind of had some interaction with him about it. And I think in my mind, they got cut because they're kind of serious conversations, kind of dour. We really wanted this kind of like, oh, Anakin's basically kind of pretending to be this sort of, you know, rapscallion brigand guy, and he's kind of doing this whole act just so he can get close to the, you know, queen so he can find out where these people are. So that kind of, if they're having a serious kind of a darker conversation, it kind of took some of the fun out of it. Because it seems like if Anakin is going to open up about that, it's going to be to Ahsoka, it's going to be serious. You know what I mean? So,
right.
So yeah, I mean, I think there's always room for that kind of thing, but I think at the end of it, you know, I think the very last scene, with Ahsoka and the Triguta, Roshti, I don't think I wrote that. I think that was something that was kind of put in there after. I think I might've had an exchange in the script between, either Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, or gosh, I can't even remember. You might have to tell me if you guys remember from the comic, but I think there was something there that was a little more personal about it, where it was kind of like, in my mind, what I wanted to go for was, well, we see the scene where Anakin makes the choice to blow up the prison and send it into the, you know, the abyss. Originally that was like boiling lava or acid or something. Really pulp style, you know, bad guy from like a Fleischer, Superman or a Flash Gordon, you know, death trap kind of thing. But I felt like there could be some kind of circled around where, you know, there are a lot of slaves that Anakin was not able to save, but he was able to save these. So some call back to like, this is only the beginning of what I want to do. You know what I mean? Like he knows that this is like a problem in the galaxy. And that's something that like once the Republic gets back on its feet, that's something that they can, you know, those are problems they can solve. Anyway, that's the idea of it.
It's got to be so distressing to him in some sense that, you know, Padme is in the Senate and there are no, I know that a large part of it has to be the war, but there's no motion put forth in the Senate to do something about the slavery issue or anything like that. I imagine that's got to be something that you could delve into and sort of, you know, explore mentally. But something I wanted to ask about was with the comic book, the it's a more diverse set of aliens that they encounter as they go through the separatist and slaver ranks. Was that something that was consciously changed for the sake of on screen, or was that something that the artist in the comic came up with a couple of designs, or had you given the direction in the comic to have, you know, more diverse aliens, and then that was just streamlined like the Sith and propaganda plot?
I think it was just a function of production. You can only afford to build so many. As it is, I can't remember the time, but I think that the character count of those episodes were way over, just because there were a lot of characters. I wrote a story where a planet full of people gets kidnapped. So you, mm-hmm. you can't show them all on screen. So, but I think what I wanted to show in the marketplace was that, like, no one is immune to this. And, even in our own country, the stuff going on in trafficking is like, hey, this is something that, like, we should be paying attention to and making sure that we stop wherever it is. And whoever's doing it needs to be stopped, that kind of thing. So in my mind, the Star Wars galaxy, there's no species that would be basically immune to it. And I think that if you think about it, though, the Zygerians, they're, you know, like a lot of slavers, are very, nationalistic about who they are. And they think they're the best. Mm. Obviously, superior. So I think they'll kind of turn their nose down at anybody, regardless of you know, species. They're always looked down. They're probably the only thing they don't look down at is money, right?
Yeah, right.
So
well,
anyway,
that was something that was.
I'm sorry. Just the short answer is that it was really a production issue, I think. And then, you know, the function of time, too.
Okay.
And that's something that I found really fascinating, too, because I liked that, you know, they added in with the show in the episodes that it's not just human trafficking, but they're also in exotic animal trafficking as well, you know. And so they're about just enslaving as many different types of beings as possible. I mean, you end up with a monkey knife fight in the episode. So, I mean, you know, things are bad for everybody in the Star Wars galaxy at this point. So even a monkey can't get a fair shake.
Yeah, I know. If you're not a Zygerian in Zygeria, chances are you're going to be at the, you know, you don't have a lot of money. You're going to be at the bottom of a hole. And someone's going to basically be bidding on you. So I think that's something. I know. One thing that almost stopped the story from happening was when the comic came out, the second issue, and I had described Ahsoka in these robes, very regal. And I know, like, oh, there's probably going to be an issue with, like, trying to get cloth simulation just because it's so expensive, but just getting her in a different outfit as it is going to be tricky. I thought her outfit ended up looking fantastic. Well, the artist drew her with, like, she was like in a Leeloo outfit from,
yes.
you know what I'm talking about. She was basically
yes.
in this
yes.
floss,
Fifth Element.
Like floss. And it was like George saw, and he was not happy about it at all. And I was horrified because I thought, cause I just saw the pencils. I thought, oh, okay. Basically this is kind of like, when I said she's in sort of this kind of, robes that are, you know, very fine and sheer, I figured, okay, that's going to be over the top in color or something like that. It never occurred to me that basically we are going to see her like that much skin exposed. So, I felt kind of awful about that. But, George basically, you know, gave us a chance to fix it in the animation.
Yeah, because the animation version creates a, I mean, I thought the outfit that they created for her was really well done, and something along the lines of what you're trying to convey, but with it, with being a little bit more tasteful, and it actually turned out to be a really cool outfit. I'm surprised nobody cosplays as that Ahsoka.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's a disguise basically, but yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of like Ahsoka crossed with Jasmine a little bit, right?
Yes,
even the same
yes,
color.
It is.
Right? It is, isn't it? I wonder. Oh my gosh, I might have to go back.
I bet they
check.
Did it on purpose.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I that would even be before the that's way pre Disney days.
Yeah, that's a very cool callback if that's the case. Absolutely.
It was super cool too, because one of the things that you guys added were this is the first instance of the laser whip that we see in canon, I believe, as well on screen. And so you have that massive fight there in this like Coliseum type place, you know, where Obi-Wan and Anakin are. And I love you guys called out on the video that our friend Nick Anastasio had edited that episode, which was really cool. But I just love that you added some really neat things to the Star Wars galaxy. And that was one of them, because that was a cool weapon.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think I originally had something. I think it's really hard to use that thing. I had this idea of playing it in another comic story where you can basically turn it all the way up and like snap it, and it's kind of like it'll kill you basically on impact, kind of like a lightsaber, but not a lightsaber. And then the idea is it's so dangerous to use, because if it comes back and nicks you, it's going to, you know, cut your hand off or whatever, just because you have that thing swinging around. So, yeah, actually, I thought it was kind of awesome that I got a chance to bring it back in Rebels, because I think what's cool about it is it says, oh, yeah, this is what slavers use. They have a whip that basically electrocutes you, and it's really not designed to kill you. It's just designed to punish you. I guess like any whip. So that was a kind of a fun callback to Rebels I got to put in there.
One thing that I had been thinking about as well was the way in which, you know, and you do this in the comic, and you do, and we got to see this somewhat in the episode where Obi-Wan sees what this life is like and experiences it, but he also experiences the first time where his action leads to others suffering pretty immediately, and it takes away kind of almost everything that he knows to do to help people, and the way in which slavery here is meant to just crush people. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to have Obi-Wan go through, because along with Satine and that relationship, we really do see that Obi-Wan throughout his life does get to experience a lot of the things that Anakin experienced, and
sure,
yet he makes different decisions. And I really like that you guys added that to his character, because I think it adds so much.
Yeah, that was something in my mind where I think, and it goes back to the whole kind of crux about the story and about power, is you're right. You know, Obi-Wan was raised with this power and taught to use it responsibly and in measure, and fighting for just and fighting for others. And then when you realize like, wait, I can't use this thing that I've been using all this time, it's really about crushing it. I think that was really something that I wanted to try to communicate. It was like, yeah, what can you do when you do have the power to help someone, but you're going to end up hurting them if you even try. And I think that's goes back to basically like being a slave, really, is when everything in your fiber is screaming out to help somebody, but you can't because you're afraid. It really comes back to fear. Like him, when he basically backs down, you realize like, yeah, he's not even thinking about himself. If it was just him, he probably would have gone down fighting, but he just keeps, you know, he's just thinking about the people around him.
Now, this is sort of tangentially related to that. So it's not really within, you know, contained just within this arc. But do you think that there's sort of an echo, a hint of, you know, Obi-Wan's regret over time? You know, we see him in Return of the Jedi say, you know, I thought I could train him just as well as Yoda. I was wrong. Do you think that he would think back to this arc, or, you know, what happens with Satine, and sort of examine it and say, why couldn't I figure this out? You know, Anakin didn't open up with Ahsoka about his past. Is it possible that contributing to Anakin's downfall was Obi-Wan not being completely open about his own?
I don't see that. And part of the reason I don't see that is that Obi-Wan was probably taken when, you know, when he was still, like a toddler. So he was too young to have formed an attachment, right, to his parents, or at least a strong enough attachment. So, but Anakin, on the other hand, the fact that Anakin, okay, was pulled away from his mom and then went back and like lost her, I think those are things that really sort of resonate with someone, because he's really like trying to kind of have, he needs power so that it doesn't happen again. And that's ultimately, when you think about it, he loses his mom, and part of him losing his mom is really he redirects that attention and that focus and that emotion at Padme, right? He's already had attracted to her, but she kind of fills that gap left by his mom at that point. So it's that maternal, not even maternal, but that feminine force in his life that you know, motivates and inspires him, right? So I think that's something that kind of he rediscovers with Attack of the Clone and then carries him through the Clone Wars. But it's hard for me to imagine that Obi-Wan has the same thing. He does have an element of it, because it's like in the story that we don't see, when he first met Satine and he was with Qui-Gon and they were basically on the run, you know, when they were teenagers, that whole thing. That was kind of like the idea of the backstory for that whole Satine Obi-Wan storyline, was that Obi-Wan had a chance. He could have basically left the order there, but he chose not to. That says something about the training he had and why you train the Jedi from such a young age. So when Yoda says he's too old, he's absolutely right. And also because of the circumstances of what ends up happening, with Anakin's mom or Ki. And that's something that Obi-Wan didn't experience, or Obi-Wan did experience loss, but I think kind of his upbringing kind of prepared him better for it. His upbringing in the Jedi Temple, that is.
So it'd be sort of a blind spot to him in that sense, where he just didn't have the same frame of reference for Anakin. So I think I plug into that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was trying to communicate in the opening scene, where Obi-Wan's talking about slavery in sort of a general term. You know, it's like, oh, he hates these guys because of the slavers. It's like, yeah, we know how evil slavery is. And that's ultimately the Obi-Wan side of the story is yeah, we know how evil it is. We really want to, he's a very empathic person when it comes to like trying to help people and feel for them. But there is that different, there's a difference between knowing that something is evil and then like experiencing how evil it is. You know what I mean? It's that thing.
This is something that's tangential to that, because it's always a question that I've wondered, and I know this won't be like an official answer, but just from your perspective, why do you think in episode one, then, with what you just said about Yoda, why does he give the okay to train this child? Is it because the Jedi are desperate for the chosen one to finally show up, or is it just because he's like, well, Obi-Wan's going to do this anyway, so I might as well just say okay?
Actually, I think I asked George about this, and I think it's the sort of situation where if you decide, like, if somebody's really powerful with the Force, and if they don't become a Jedi, the Jedi just don't let them run around out there. And I said, well, what does that mean? What do you mean the Jedi just don't let them run around out there? They send them to the farm, you know, like you do with your dog or something. It's like, and he kind of implied, and maybe I just misunderstood him, but he seemed to imply that, like, yeah, the Jedi just don't let, like, you know, they won't let somebody abuse the Force who has that power. And I know it happens out there, and there's people like Ventress and like that, but there's not a lot of them that aren't like scooped up by the Jedi, because the Jedi are, when you think about it, they're pretty rare. I guess it makes sense that there's bound to be some out there that are, you know, have escaped, you know, the Jedi. But that's, it seems like they pretty much get found pretty quick and recruited. I don't know. Does that answer your question? Well, I guess in my mind, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say that actually that sort of jibes with what we know about from the Jedi Apprentice series, that Obi-Wan was going to go to the Agricultural Corps in the service of the Jedi, but not become a full Padawan. But it was Qui-Gon who found him at that time. So that would sort of go in line with that idea that the Jedi, if they find someone, aren't just going to let them run around if they have, you know, access to that sort of potential.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. But also, I think later on, George and Dave, or Dave had said somewhere that pretty much if you don't use it and you don't, you know, really develop it, you probably aren't going to be able to do much with it. So I think that's really kind of probably more accurate. Is if you don't have the training, then, you know, you probably couldn't become somebody who's really good with it. Of course, The Force Awakens totally like shoots that whole sentence out of the water, what I just said.
Yep, it sure does.
Okay, you know what? Never
somebody
mind.
Somebody named Carrie Poppins.
Yeah, boy, that's a good point. That's making me scratch my head right there.
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the things, you know, when we're talking about the mysteries of the Force and everything, and of course when it comes to Anakin, I think it really does make sense in the end that the Jedi would and Yoda would make the decision to say, okay, we already know that there's a Sith out there, and we know that he recruited one person under our nose, and we didn't even know it. If we just let this kid go, who's so powerful in the Force, that's not a good idea. So it's a better idea for us to train him and keep him under our wing, because we don't want him coming under anybody else's wing. So I guess that does, when you think about the logic of what happened in episode one, and it makes sense why he would begrudgingly say, you know, we'll train him.
Just to tack on to that, and again, I know this isn't official necessarily, but in the novelization by Terry Brooks, there is a sentence or two that says that the council went against Yoda's advice, that like he was against it, and the council was like, they outvoted him, basically.
I remember that.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, because I wonder if that's the sort of thing that, like, why George didn't put that in the movie, you know? Because it's think about it, it's like, well, does that mean Yoda has veto power?
Right. Right.
You know, was it, like, a close? Was it 7-5?
Right.
You know what I mean? That's kind of really interesting that was in the novel. Because, yeah, I seem to remember that. I had asked about, when I did the adaptation for Phantom Menace, I had asked about elements of the book and putting it into the adaptation, the movie adaptation. So it'd be like, oh, it's something different. But George is like totally against that. He was like, no. I want the comic book to be exactly the movie. So close, in fact, that the artist Rodolfo DiMaggio, he did a lot of tracing of stills to get like the likenesses really like dead on. And that's something that George wanted was my original pitch. I had pitched couple of different artists, but one of the artists I'd pitched was Bruce Timm to do the adaptation, which would have brought a completely different like sensibility to it. It would have been much more dynamic as far as, you know, graphic rather than realistic. And it, Lucasfilm wanted it to be very realistic. I wonder
if some of that is maybe an echo of because I remember reading some articles about the Howard Chaykin adaptation of the original film, and that he, and especially with what happened in the issues immediately after the adaptation, that by Chaykin's own words, Lucas wasn't thrilled with the direction that he was taking the characters or the story. Or even some of the things he had done in the adaptation. Now, that, you know, that's Chaykin's own point of view about things. So who knows how skewed that is. But I imagine, you know, I guess that might have shaped his desires when it came to adapting the next series. Because I know the Empire and Jedi adaptations were like that. The Al Williamson artwork on that was much closer to the films.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No. And it's funny you should say that. Al was basically requested to ink the Phantom Menace, and Attack of the Clones. Yeah. He was requested by George himself because he wanted Williamson.
Wow.
Since Williamson had done that fantastic work on the old Flash Gordon stuff. As well as the Star Wars stuff. So I think it's really interesting that, but that's, you know, George likes what he likes. He has that kind of sense that he has a great taste in art. So he definitely would kind of keep that tradition alive rather than doing something different. Didn't Marvel recently redo that adaptation?
I think they redid the adaptation I know they redid it in 97 because of the addition of the Jabba scene. And I think they redid the art to make it more less stylized, as it were.
Yeah, did they do I'm sorry, I meant the prequels. Am I missing that? I mean, no. Marvel recently, though. Did Marvel recently put out a different version of the comic book adaptation to the film, or is it just a reprint?
They could have, but I don't remember.
It would be the last couple of years. I wasn't sure if they did or they just reprinted the Dark Horse stuff.
I know that they did a three volume, one for the prequels and one for the original trilogy, where it was a comic adaptations for both trilogies. Kind of skewed a tiny bit younger, you know. And like I've seen them at like Target and stuff. And so it's all three of the movies from each trilogy, for a great way to kind of introduce your kids to. So it could be that that's what I'm thinking of.
That sounds right. I remember seeing it advertised in some of the Marvel stuff, and I was like, oh, what the heck is this? So. Interesting,
but I know that they have your and they still have the original episodes as they were, and they've just reprinted them in new volumes now that Marvel has the line back. And so in fact, they've got the episode one collection and everything as well. And it's interesting to me the way that comics have influenced. In fact, John and I have recently talked about the new Darth Vader comics that Charles Soule's been doing just after episode three, and it's been wonderful. So, you know, the comic medium can add so much. And I remember, I wanted to tell you this, I remember I was working at Barnes & Noble when your comic issues of this series came out.
Oh, that's great.
And I was getting to read them, and I was in love with them because I was just so in love with the show at that point. I was so excited to be getting more Clone Wars, and I just ate them up. Like every time they came in, I was like the first one to read them, and they were just so good. And then when, you know, they ended up being episodes, it was even better. It was like, oh, I've already read this story. This is awesome.
I still have the first issue with my bag and backer board in my little
nice.
Select collection over here.
That's
awesome.
Nice.
I'll have to sign those for you one day. Well, I don't know. Maybe that'll ruin the value of them, but.
No, it wouldn't to me, not in the least.
I know. In gratitude, because, you know, Randy Stradley, who wrote so many and edited so many fantastic Star Wars books, I named Darth Dinar after Randy Stradley, which is Rand Strad backwards. Anyway, just so you know, just because I felt like, okay, Randy like doesn't get credit. I think he wrote a bunch of Star Wars books under a pseudonym or something like that. I think he finally came out about it, but he just was, I think, really great for 15 years and telling a lot of fantastic Star Wars stories. Really supportive of creators, but also like he was great at protecting the brand as well. I definitely have a soft spot for those Dark Horse Star Wars books. I think they're really cool.
Was there, before we let you go, this is a completely different type of question, but was there ever a comic book story idea for Star Wars that you had in your mind and you just never got a chance to do, but you'd love to see it done sometime?
You know, there were a couple that I worked on. I mean, Steve Melching, by the way, he did some great, like helped on these episodes, with some of the dialogue, which was really fun working with Steve. There's a couple that I wrote. Dave and I'd always talked about doing like the kind of a Red Baron, like bad guy, separatist pilot story. And we did do that comic book, but there's some stories that they so lend themselves to the cinematic sort of medium better. And I tend to write more that way anyway, with movement and scenes that kind of play out visually, kind of what's going on with the characters and stuff. So I'm trying to think. There's one story element, which this is so bizarre. It was actually one of the first – I pitched like four stories for the beginning of Clone Wars. The Malevolence was one of them. The Lost R2 arc was another one, and then the basic premise for the Castle series with Jabba's son. Those were like the three stories, and the one story that wasn't approved was the Mandalorian armor storyline, which was basically about Dooku, who had somehow, and this is kind of before a lot of the backstory about the Beskar armor, a Beskar alloy was created. So it was basically Dooku found out how to copy the Beskar alloy and was making battle droids that were basically blaster proof.
Wow.
And so he had made a deal with the Mandalorian. So it was basically this giant Mandalorian Jedi war within Clone Wars. And I think George's note was simply that, Jango's not a Mandalorian, so the story won't work. And I was like, but no, it can work. It's just a different thing. What's awesome is I was able to basically go back and as these stories are kind of, they go away and then they come back again if they're a good idea. And in Rebels, we really kind of got a chance to get in there and talk about how important the armor is to the Mandalorians and what it's made of and why it has this cultural importance. So, I mean, that was way before it. Also, I think at that point, George blew us away when I also pitched out. He's like, oh, besides that whole thing about Jango not being a Mandalorian, but he's like, I think he ended it with, yeah, Jango's not a Mandalorian, and then the Mandalorians are pacifist.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
And then, so yeah, you guys are laughing, and Dave and I looked at each other like, what the heck? What? But Boba Fett and Mandalorian Warrior, and, anyway. whenever we would, or probably usually me, I'd ever say, but George would always say, you know, all these books are written by some guy in Britain. Don't pay any attention to them. So, and the reason why is that's why there was the expanded universe, because when George is doing something, he wanted the freedom to basically develop the storylines however he wanted to, not be like hemmed in, you know. I think that's kind of an iffy situation. So it's definitely a challenge now for Lucasfilm, just because they're trying to make everything canon. And when you make everything canon, it's definitely bound to, you know, put you in some corners now and then.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah, that's, I love that. But I mean, then where you went in the Clone Wars with the Mandalorians, and then, you know, where it ended up taking with Maul and all of that stuff, and then flowing right into what you guys did in Rebels. I mean, the storyline ends up being so much more fascinating, I think, personally, than just it being what they thought they were, because we get to see mm-hmm. this progression of a society who's old and it's been through different iterations of itself, and part of, you know, its history was to be pacifist for a while and try something it hadn't tried before, and then, you know, the Empire comes and everything goes to heck again. So, you know, it's I felt like, you know, what Clone Wars and the comics and Rebels has been able to do is flesh out the universe of Star Wars in a way that you just can't do in a 2-hour film. And I think that's the beauty of animation specifically. And then, of course, as you got to do in the comic, you get to bring these worlds to life in whole new ways. And like you know, a 6-issue comic series, you got to do more than you could do in the episodes, just because you have more time and more page space to be able to play out with the story more. And so, you know, all these mediums, they work differently, but it just goes to show how rich the universe of Star Wars is when people creating it really, you know, get it. And they kind of subvert our expectations in those ways. But hey, it can also be great when that happens too.
Ultimately, I think that's the best, is when you can kind of flip it around. You know, I mean, spoiler alert, but having Snoke gets unceremoniously cut in half was like, wait, what? Did that just happen? Holy crap, that's great. I don't know how you guys feel about that. I can't remember if we talked about Last Jedi last time, but I that was one of those things where I was not expecting that, and I was really refreshed by it, because it I think really the great thing about Star Wars, it surprises you, and it kind of leads you into this universe where anything can happen.
For sure. The element of surprise is something that we hope they definitely keep alive going forward. And, you know, just looking forward to all of that. So, but before we let you go, just want to thank you again for being on the show, for coming along and talking to us. And, you know, as well, you know, you have an open invitation anytime you want to join us on the airwaves.
Oh, thanks, guys. Maybe, like we said, we'll do the solo thing, whenever that happens.
Yeah, that'd be great. And before you go, just tell everybody, where can they follow you on Twitter if they want to catch up with what's going on with you?
Yeah, it's at HGilroy67.
Awesome.
So, I haven't been on a lot lately, but hopefully I'll be on again soon. So, you guys take care. Thanks for having me, and keep in touch. May the Force be with you.
I love talking to him.
He's
awesome.
So much fun.
He is, you know,
he's so kind.
He really, really and truly is. And just can't thank him enough. Henry, thank you for being on the show. Matt, if people want to reach you online, where can they find you?
Well, John, they can catch up with me on Twitter at MattRushing02. They can also find me on Instagram under the same name. I'm also here on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter with Treya Kaufman. We do each and every chapter of Harry Potter, one chapter at a time, so make sure you check that out with Outpost. Really enjoy being over on the Trek FM Network, where I'm talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Chris Jones on The Orb. We're back. We got our brand new episode out, so make sure you check that out. And the 602 Club, where we're talking about all things geeky, every franchise we can. We'll obviously be having some Star Wars come up. We'll be having Solo come up. We've got the brand new Last Shot book we'll be doing before Solo comes out as well. So just check out the 602 Club. You're going to love it because John's there a lot. So, and we all know you love John. And because people love you so much, John, and where your moniker is about to get super famous, where can everybody find you?
Nobody loves me, but that's okay. They can find me as Kessel Junkie on Twitter most of the time and elsewhere too from time to time. You can find me right here on the network co-hosting Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler, where we look at the more technical aspects of filmmaking and some of the breaking news from behind the scenes. And you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. So with all of that being said, Matt, I think there's only one thing left to say. I think it's time to close negotiations.
John, negotiations are closed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.